Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Studio 2, the radio show that brings you a dynamic fusion of topics that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We are your hosts, Jerry Gregg and Avi Wolfman-Aaron, and today we have an incredible lineup that will take you on a thrilling journey through the realms of ChatGPT, the fascinating discoveries at Avery's Rest excavation site, and of course, everyone's favorite day of the week, Taco Tuesday.
Avi, I don't know. That sounds like you had some help with ChatGPT right
now.
Oh, there.
How dare you accuse me of such things.
I'm not believing that one. Well, we are going to be talking to a local professor who is using that technology in his classroom, and we want to hear what you think about AI like ChatGPT in education. Will it help or harm critical thinking? I don't know if it helped or harmed that copy there, but
it was,
you know,
okay.
It was all right. Or should we just lean all the way in and embrace it? The number for your question or comments is 888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org. That was good, though.
It was okay.
Your delivery was good.
There would have been some red pen in there if I was reviewing it. I like dynamic fusion, though.
We are
going to get to all those topics today. I don't think I need to repeat them. Yes, we're going to talk about Taco Tuesday. Yes, we will talk about the Avery's Rest excavation site. But before we get to all of that, Sharon, we have some breaking news to attend to.
Yeah, Philadelphia Police Commissioner Danielle Outlaw is resigning. Her last day will be September 22nd. The notice came today when Mayor Jim Kenney posted about it on X. Outlaw says her leaving is voluntary. She's moving on to become Deputy Chief Security Officer at the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. And if you recall, I know you remember the day Outlaw joined PPD back in February of 2020. She was the first Black woman to lead the department. And, you know, in his statement, Kenny said she has worked relentlessly for 3.5 years during an unprecedented era in our city. And just as a reminder, a month after she got here, the city went on lockdown because of the pandemic. 3 months after she got here, George Floyd protests broke out.
Yep.
I mean, there was the Walter Wallace shooting that October. And we had her on the show just recently.
Yep.
And things have been, homicides have been trending down, shootings trending down. And then, of course, you know, the shooting and killing of Eddie Irizarry. So a lot has happened during her tenure. By the way, Mayor Jim Kenney has appointed First Deputy John Stanford Jr., Outlaw's top deputy, as interim commissioner. Lots to talk about there. Yeah.
Well, look, the timing is conspicuous. We don't have any inside information, but a new mayor is coming.
Yeah.
Pretty soon.
Yep. Yep.
Was a conversation had between her and some, I remember when you had her on the show,
you asked her
whether she had talked with Sherelle Parker.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she said there were some rules that prohibited direct communication. But just because there isn't direct communication doesn't mean there isn't indirect communication.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know. We don't know if this is because of the new mayor.
Maybe she was just tired.
Maybe
it was,
maybe she really likes this opportunity at the Port Authority
of New York
and New Jersey. But obviously the timing is notable just as an outside observer. And as you mentioned, an interesting event-filled 3.5-year tenure. I was looking back and seeing sort of 3.5 years as a tenure length. How does that fit in? It's on the short side.
Yeah.
It's not outlier short, but it is on the short side for a PPD commissioner over the last 20, 25 years.
And she came in at a tough time. There had been a scandal, sexual, you know, assault allegations against the former commissioner. So there's, you know, there was a lot going on. And, you know, we wish her well.
Also on the show last week, we had on Tony Watlington.
Yeah, we were hitting on all cylinders lately, right?
the new Philadelphia school superintendent. This is his second year in charge, and you did, I think, or maybe I did. One of us asked him, whether schools would be on delay as they get underway this week and they welcome children back. And indeed, 70 schools in the school district are doing early dismissal on the first day and at least tomorrow because of the heat. These are schools in Philadelphia without air conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is there's a massive heat wave right now. Early September could be one of the bigger September heat waves we've had here in Philadelphia. And so it's affecting schools. It's affecting everything about daily life. And we will keep our eye on it.
Yeah. What was interesting to me about this is that we could have more above 90 degree days in September than we had in August.
It was a cool August.
We had a great, it was a great August weather wise. But of course, all the storms and rain and all that, those things. But, you know, I hate that kids are going to be, you know, having shorter days on the first week.
Yeah.
Don't
I
like
was
that.
On my walk in today, I actually passed by a school as parents were dropping off for the first time. Mm-hmm. Got a little misty eyed, actually. It's such a wonderful scene.
Pictures.
It really is.
I love the pictures.
But that everyone was doing the pictures right with the the brother and sister standing next to each other in the uniform. But of course, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking this is not a great way to start the school year. So the weather not cooperating. And of course, this is all tied into the infrastructure woes that the school district has experienced over many, many decades, due in part to underfunding. And the fact that many schools do not have air conditioning, of course, is related to all of that.
Yeah. And speaking of schools. Two Pennsylvania school districts announced that their buildings will be closed today as a result, guess what, Avi, an ongoing manhunt. You probably heard about the escape. Pennsylvania State Police, they gave an update on a prison escapee in Chester County this morning. 34-year-old Daniello Calvacante escaped from Chester County Prison just outside of Philly on Thursday. He had been sentenced to life in prison without parole for stabbing 33-year-old Deborah Brandow to death in 2021 while her kids were present. He had been awaiting a transfer to a state facility when he escaped. Authorities say there have been six credible sightings since that time. In one sighting near Longwood Gardens, he had been seen wearing a hooded sweatshirt and a duffel bag, unknown where he got it. But Westchester University had increased police presence. Everybody's very concerned, but authorities say they're closing in.
Yep. And this has become a national story.
Yes.
Actually. So we will keep our eye on this one as well, hoping for a resolution sometime soon.
Speaking of eyes.
Eyes in the sky. This real quickly wanted to talk about New Jersey being the first state to use drones to investigate suspected labor violations at construction sites. Really interesting story on this topic up right now at NJ.com. Mm-hmm. Look, there are always reports of potential labor violations at these big sprawling construction sites. It's hard to infiltrate them or show up and actually sort of gauge whether or not the violations are occurring. So New Jersey has deployed some folks who know how to drive drones, fly drones, to use these drones from like 300 plus feet away to zoom in and monitor the sites and see if violations are occurring. And perhaps the fact that they are broadcasting this will be a deterrent for folks who might think about breaking labor laws.
Yeah, and they got folks on the payroll already, 12 folks. So we'll see what happens there. Moving on to our newsmaker.
Staying in New Jersey.
Yeah, in New Jersey. It's a David versus Goliath story. A South Jersey restaurant beloved by locals has owned the trademark for Taco Tuesday today, my favorite day of the week. They've owned that trademark for over 40 years. But now, one of the biggest fast food chains in the world, well, they want it canceled. The trademark owned by Gregory's Restaurant and Bar in Summers Point, New Jersey, is the subject of a lawsuit filed by Taco Bell that will head to a federal patent court. And joining us now to talk about it is Gregory Gregory, the restaurant's third generation owner. Greg Gregory, welcome to Studio 2.
Why, thank you for the welcome. And it was nice to hear you talking about our 45 years of Taco Tuesday.
And explain to folks, Greg, this is the first Taco Tuesday of the season because you run this promotion seasonally, right?
That's correct. In the summer, it's way too busy. We're right next to Ocean City, New Jersey, and we have a very strong summer business that takes up too much time in our kitchen. And the Taco Tuesday is a promotion that we started in 79 to try and get some business on an off night. And now it's turned into a great night for us and a great night for the people. We offer it to the locals and to the travelers themselves, you know, the tourists. But it starts in the winter. It goes from now till the last week of June. And it's Tuesdays. And we even have a rollover on Thursday for families.
Very nice. I want you to tell us a brief version of the 1979 story. You discovered tacos yourself and decided to create, quote, Taco Tuesday. Tell us the story.
Well, I was running a restaurant in the Philadelphia Gallery Shopping Center, and I went down to the food court to do some research to see what people were buying, you know, what people were eating, because I'm going to be making a menu for the family business I was taking over in January. So when I got to the food court, there was a place that had TACO written there. That's all it was on top of the, in the food court. And there was a line there every day a line. And I said, I got to try this. So it's, all it said was TACO. So I go up to the lady and I said, I'll have a taco. She says, she tells me it's taco. It's Tex-Mex. I said, oh, okay. I'll try one. I'm all excited. I take a bite and it was, I just didn't like it. I didn't like it, but I'm in the business of serving food that people like, not what I like. Mm. And I wanted to put it on the menu. And in 1979, when we came down here, there weren't any Mexican places. So we had to figure out what we could do. And they said, let's do it one night a week. And I said, okay, well, why don't we do it on Tuesday, Taco Tuesday? We'll call it Taco Tuesday. Yeah, that sounds good. We'll call it Taco Tuesday.
Wow.
It got so busy that my college professor came in and insisted on helping us get a trademark for it. After some diligent work, we were awarded our trademark in 1982.
And so you've had the trademark just in New Jersey, I believe, since 1989. That's correct. So you guys can use that phrase Taco Tuesday in New Jersey. Rival businesses cannot.
Absolutely correct.
And at some point there was Taco John's, which had the trademark in the other 49 states outside of New Jersey. And Taco Bell was, you know, going after both of you. And then Taco John's dropped out.
Yeah, quite a mystery.
Yeah, so you have no idea why Taco Bell wants to, I guess in their terms, liberate the trademark, which is basically make it so that anyone can use it. They've never told you, hey, Greg, this is why we want to do it.
Well, it's obvious. If anybody's been in business for 5 minutes, they know what's obvious. It's all about the money. They want to start a Taco Tuesday promotion for themselves. And understandably, I would too if I was going to do it. But right now, I own it. We own the trademark, and that's all there is to it.
And so you have, I mean, you're a small business here in our region, and then you have big old worldwide Taco Bell. What keeps you in it and has your feet kind of grounded and say, you're going to fight this out? What's your motivating factor?
Well, to tell you the truth, you know, I have a gentleman that stepped up, a white knight that offered to protect me, help me, and turn this into a little bit of a more fair fight. Mm. And he's helping me out. I have an attorney, Scott Makem, a local guy that I've known for years. And he said, listen, this isn't fair. I don't like this. I'm a David and Goliath guy. I'm a wrestler. I want to do the
Got
right
a wrestler.
Thing. I said, okay, let's do it. So we're in it to win it.
And I guess the question is, like, what would you really lose if indeed Taco Bell or any other business starts using it? Because you got a 40-year head start. Everyone loves your Taco Tuesday. If other people started using the phrase, would it really hurt your business?
Well, it is mine, and it would hurt my business if the bar next door started Taco Tuesday or the taco stand down the street had Taco Tuesday. It's part of my business model. It's the day that we use to pay our payroll the next day. It's so strong, and it's ours. We own it. We pay.
And as we wrap up, you have less than 30 seconds. Tell us, what do you want Taco Bell? What do you want to say to Taco Bell? Big old Taco Bell.
I wish they would leave me alone or continue the talks and figure something out here. It's not right. It's not fair. And we're going to fight the fight.
That is Greg Gregory, third generation owner of Gregory's Restaurant in Summers Point, New Jersey. They are the original trademark owner of Taco Tuesday, and they intend to keep it that way. Greg, thanks so much for joining us on Studio 2.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the support.
Coming up next, ChatGPT at school. Email us your questions or comments at studio2@whyy.org. You can also call us at 888-477-9499. A little Jimmy Buffett here for you as we stick with us.
I want to be there. Want to go back to supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Studio 2. I am Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Students are back in class. Alongside them, ChatGPT, the artificial intelligence language program that debuted last November, at least for the public. Since then, teachers and students have been wrestling with what it means for education and learning. After all, Cherry, this bot can write a term paper in just seconds, design a college course syllabus equally fast.
Cheating is a huge concern, especially since there's really no way to detect if an essay is ChatGPT generated. So if you can't fight it, embrace it. That's what some educators are doing, resigned to the idea that AI is here to stay. University of Pennsylvania Wharton professor Ethan Mollick is one of these teachers who is incorporating ChatGPT into his teaching and has been studying what it means for the future of education. He's here with us now in our studio. Ethan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And you can call us with your questions or comments. How do you think ChatGPT will change how students or your student learns? Yeah. Call us 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
All right, Ethan, let's ground this in your teaching, your pedagogy. So give me an example of a course that you teach, because you require students to use ChatGPT in your courses. Give me an example of a course and what require ChatGPT actually entails in practice.
Perfect. Well, I teach entrepreneurship at Wharton, which is a pretty useful thing to be teaching in the era of chat, not just because entrepreneurship is useful, but because it gives you flexibility. If I was trying to teach English composition or something, it would be a little bit harder, right? Teaching people to write. But now I am able to make my students do a lot more than before, push things a lot further. So, for example, a typical assignment before ChatGPT, write an outline for a business plan you're going to put together. Mm-hmm. After ChatGPT, it now requires you to do at least one impossible thing in your outline. So if you couldn't code before, you have to write working computer apps. If you weren't able to do graphic design, I expect a full working website. Every assignment has to be critiqued by at least three famous entrepreneurs through history that you have to simulate with ChatGPT, which might sound funny, but actually is valuable because entrepreneurs need outside feedback and they don't get that enough. So these different perspectives are very helpful.
Wait, so the student tells ChatGPT, I want you to critique my business plan in the voice of someone from the past?
So the AI is actually pretty good at simulating people. And so I have them simulate, you know, Jack Ma or Rihanna or whoever they want, and give them a critique in their voice about their plan. So just different perspectives. It's not going to be accurate, of course, but it's a way of getting different perspectives involved.
And so I want to just stop for a second, because Ethan, you've leaned all the way in and I love it. But you were not always embracing this. You were a skeptic at first. What sort of flipped the switch in your mind to say, you know what, I shouldn't be afraid of this or worried about this. Instead, I should have my students use it.
Oh, I'm both afraid and worried too.
Just to be clear,
it's the full set of things. This is a very profound change, right? So I've actually been having my students use versions of earlier forms of large language models and AI before ChatGPT came out, and they would write comfortably at sort of a fifth grade level. So the idea was, it was sort of a toy to show people, look, this is interesting. And I actually had students try and cheat using AI both before and after ChatGPT. So they had to write an essay and have the AI fake an essay from them. And it was very obvious for the earlier versions, which was what I was skeptical about. So it didn't seem like this was getting anywhere very quickly. There's been lots of AI promises. And then Chat came out at the end of November, and suddenly it was like very clear, this is something very different, right? It aces every exam we throw at it. It, beats every people on the SAT, GRE, board exam, neurosurgery qualifying exam, completely changes education.
Okay, wow. So let's just make sure that for folks who haven't used this before, they understand how it works. So my understanding of ChatGPT is it's like a conversation. You prompt it to give you something, and then you can sort of type a response back. No, I want this or I want that. I want you to tweak it. Give folks a sense of how ChatGPT, the platform that we have access to, the version of it we have access to, actually works.
Great. So it's called a large language model, and it sort of solves this problem of AI has been around for a while, but when we thought about AI, we either would think about the Terminator or we think about like large companies like Amazon trying to predict what we might want to buy next, right? It was using like lots of data to predict stuff, but it was very bad at predicting language. So large language models are this way of training AIs on everything humans have ever written, and then they're able to produce realistic, natural-sounding language in response. And we kind of know how they work, but we don't know why they're working so well all of a sudden. So they've been around for a while, but ChatGPT, the size of the model that we have, and the version that you have for free is called GPT 3.5. The more advanced version is GPT 4. People can still get free access to that using Microsoft's Bing in its purple creative mode. But in either case, these models are very good and unexpectedly so. So all they're doing is kind of predicting the next word in a sentence, but they're doing it at a level that makes it almost feel like they're thinking. They're not, but we get that kind of quality. So it's not just reproducing text that's seen. It's not just copying and pasting, which is why, as you said, you can't detect its writing. It is actually creating new content based on everything it's been trained on. So you're interacting with it. You're typing a question and it answers you. You say, make that paragraph, you know, funnier. It'll do that. Make it rhyme. It'll do that. These are all capabilities in the system.
It feels almost like a very advanced version of when I go on Verizon and try to get like their cybersecurity chatbot help thing to help me with whatever problem I'm having with Verizon. The interface works like that, but it's a far more sophisticated version of it.
Exactly. And it's going to be coming to all kinds of other interfaces. So every version of Microsoft Word is going to have a button where you can actually have it just create your essay for you, which is going to make cheating that much harder. Every email you get will have an option to reply with AI. And this is not like a future thing. This is already, Microsoft already announced this. So it's not just going to be via chat. It's everything you do is going to have this generative AI built in.
If you are just tuning in, we are speaking with Ethan Mollick, associate professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He studies and teaches innovation and entrepreneurship and has leaned all the way in and is actually embracing the use of ChatGPT and other artificial intelligence. If you have questions or comments about use of GPT or other AI in education, call 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2 at whyy.org. So I was teaching for a few years at Temple University. And last semester, when I was teaching my journalism law class, I had a student submit some. And it was very hard to tell, but I could tell that her writing got exceptionally better from the beginning of the semester to the end. And I suspected that she used ChatGPT or some type of assistance. I want you to kind of lay out how young people are or students are using it in the classroom to assist. And is all of it just sort of writing the papers, or are there other uses there?
So there's a ton of uses, but we should start off with like everyone's cheating. I mean, they were already cheating, right? Everybody was already cheating. It just was, there were ways of detecting it or we ignored it. So it's just become much more obvious that everyone's cheating now. Mm-hmm. And these are not detectable. Once people use them, we have to do like the essay as we know it is under threat. We have to think about new ways of grading. Maybe we go back to blue books. We can talk about all that, but it's not all downside, right? One of the most powerful things you can do as an instructor is one-on-one tutoring. We have all this research showing that if I could do one-on-one tutoring with you, you increase like performance from like the 50th percentile to 98th percentile in the class. But of course, that's really expensive, right? We can't do that as professors. We can't do that as teachers. There is some hope and signs already that AI is actually a pretty good one-on-one tutor. So my students have stopped raising their hands so much in class. And you ask them why. They're like, why would I want to tell everyone I don't know something when I can ask chat to explain that thing to me? So another thing I give my students is a series of prompts that actually make it work like a tutor. And so so not just giving them answers, but asking them questions to understand what they know and challenging them to think differently. So it really creates new ways of teaching and learning, but it also challenges some of the ways that we're used to teaching. And if we don't adapt, a lot of the kinds of assignments we do aren't going to work anymore.
So ChatGPT can write your papers for you. It can tutor you. What else can it do in the classroom?
Oh, it's pretty amazing. I mean, it creates, like, if I want to create an interactive tool to explain statistics, it'll generate a web page for me with, like, sliders and stuff so I can actually run experiments on it. It will do things like it works as virtual teammates. So my classes work in teams. I have it work as a coach to help teams work better together to solve problems. I use it, I have students use it as a way of testing what they know. And we actually ask them to explain things to chat, and chat will suddenly get stuff wrong and they have to be a teacher themselves and correct the material that ChatGPT comes up with. There's just a huge number of uses. It's a really fascinating technology.
So it's an incredibly powerful tool, and you want your students to be able to harness its power. And that's why you encourage them to use it on your assignments. Is that kind of in the ballpark?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's kind of a couple cases, right? The first is exactly that. I want people to get to know how to use this. I think it's important. It's here, right?
Yeah.
We could debate all we want about whether it would be a good idea or not a good idea to have this, but we all have access to this tool. And by the way, you were mentioning earlier, like, the most powerful tool we have access to. The fascinating thing is the most powerful tool that everyone has access to for free in 169 countries is the most powerful AI you can get anywhere. You go to the world's top five companies, they have the same AI that you have access to, which is kind of crazy. So the first thing is this idea of using it. The second is I think it can really boost education. And the third is, like, this is the worst AI you're ever going to use. So my students need to be ready for a world where AI is going to get better and better.
So they need to get better at sort of using the correct types of prompts to manipulate the ChatGPT to give them what the work product that they need, because they're going to need to do that in their job someday.
Yes, although I have a feeling, based on where I'm seeing things go, that that's not going to be as much of a problem, because the AI will kind of know what you want. Like, you could just sort of say, like, I'm in Ethan Mollick's class, to help me get an A.
Oh,
and
gosh.
It will give you all the information you need to do that, or at least it will be able to soon. So I don't know how much the training is sort of getting used to the system. I don't know if we're going to be using it the same way a year or two from now.
Well, that's kind of terrifying, though, is it not?
It is. And I want to bring in a caller who also works in education, is a college professor. Chase is on the line. He says, it's easy to detect what is ChatGPT and what is written by the student. Chase, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thank you. So I would just say briefly that it's actually quite easy to determine when ChatGPT writes a college paper. The reason is that ChatGPT surveys a field. Very few students understand a field. ChatGPT writes from the top down, like an encyclopedic entry, whereas students write from the bottom up. The particular thing that they're asked to write about is what they focus on. Also, the language is very clear to determine. It's very artificial. It is actually not very smart. Not yet. And I will just say one last thing, which is I had a group of 60 students. I had a paper last semester. I knew that they were using ChatGPT. I gave them a weekend to come to me, but I had already picked out 10 papers that use ChatGPT. 12 came to me. The 10 that I picked all confessed that they use ChatGPT. So it's not as indeterminate to see it as people think. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chase. Chase is like Inspector Gadget over there when it comes to ChatGPT. If you have a comment or you want to join the conversation, you can call 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. Ethan, I want you to react to that.
So I would say a few things. One is, we're probably talking for this last semester, GPT 3.5, which is much weaker than GPT 4. The second thing I would say is that when I assign students to use AI well, that means interact with it multiple times, like we were talking about, make this better, add a different example, the second paragraph, it is indistinguishable. No AI detector can detect it. In fact, OpenAI just pulled their AI detector from the market. They're the people who make ChatGPT, because it doesn't detect writing. And the problem is it creates a lot of false positives, especially if English is your second language. You may be detected as writing like ChatGPT. So the thing I worry about is when professors are using their gut feel to figure out who's using chat and who isn't, they're catching the bad chat users, not necessarily all the chat users, and they may be going on signals that are false, right?
So or it's out hard of date to, already.
Exactly. Wow. So it's hard to police this kind of thing, and I worry that policing it just means you're kind of picking people you think might be cheating and accusing them of cheating, and we have no evidence of it. So it's a really hard thing.
And that was one of the reasons why I was afraid to even speak to call out my student, because it was a hunch, but you have no proof.
And then the question is, are you calling out the other students who are better at using it? And now all you're doing is getting the people who aren't as good users. Mm. Is that fair? So it's a really big question, but cheating, bad use is detectable. Good use, we've already proven, is not.
All right. If you want to join this conversation about ChatGPT in the classroom, 888-477-9499 is the number. The email address is studio2@whyy.org. Speaking with Ethan Mollick, professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, something of a ChatGPT evangelist. I don't know if you like that particular term.
Of evangelist of two minds. Like, I think this is here and we have to figure out how to use it, but I also think that there are reasons to be worried or upset or afraid as well.
Can we get into that? Because you gave the theoretical example of someone could just type in at some point to something like ChatGPT, help me get an A in Ethan's course, and it could give them a roadmap, basically, to do so. And the point of doing an assignment in college is not necessarily to create the work product, but also to learn how to create the work product so that you can do things like it in the future. And if I'm just asking ChatGPT to get me an A, I don't know how I would possibly learn anything in your course.
We're going to have to change education. I mean, to be very honest, in the long term, this is why it's a very mixed message. I'm trying to evangelize the idea that we have to deal with this. This is not a future thing. The homework apocalypse is today. Like, we have to figure out how to deal with this. But that we're going to have to change education. Now, education will be fine. We actually know the model that works, which is called the flipped classroom with active learning, which means you'll do a lot of tutoring and other sessions where you learn basic facts with chat help or video help outside of class. And inside of class will be activities, putting things to use. We'll be okay. We'll figure all of that out. Mm-hmm. Some classes, like English writing, will ban chat, and you'll do a lot of writing in class, and there just won't be as many out-of-class assignments. We'll figure that stuff out. I'm more profoundly kind of concerned about what we do, what we're training people for, right? I'm in a business school. What does the world of work look like when AI does a pretty good job writing marketing material, does a good job writing code? What does that look like
five years from now? If I was a super creative person and my great asset to my employer was I'm great at writing marketing emails and I could do it pretty quickly compared to the average human, well, now I can't because ChatGPT or some later version of it is going to blow me out of the water, right?
And in ways we don't expect. So my colleagues, Carl Ulrich and Christian Turwich, just did a paper where they compared, they have a canonically amazing product design course that they teach. One of them actually wrote the book on product design. And they compared the ideas that students came up with in the class with the ideas that ChatGPT came up with. And ChatGPT came with better ideas than the students, Out of the top 10 ideas, most were from chat.
Jeez. And I want to bring in another caller, another teacher. Kathy's on the line, wants to join the conversation. And then I have a question for you that I'm sure will piggyback on what Kathy has to say. Kathy, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, my comment is I was a teacher for many years, all ages, elementary school through adult. I have a master's in education. What I always taught my students was that in order to be a good writer, it forces you to clarify your thoughts. And if you're taking away that opportunity for those students of practicing and practicing and refining and refining and really figuring out what it is they want to say and the best way they can say it, you're stealing that opportunity from those students, including coming up with their own original ideas.
Thank you so much,
That's
Kathy. And my follow-up question is right in line with what Kathy had to say. Does it make us less smart? I mean, because because you're relying heavily, you haven't fleshed it out, your critical thinking skills are going to be questionable. What is some of the downsides of producing kids from Wharton School that haven't really gone through that process?
We don't want to give that up, right? I think Kathy was completely right. Like, we part of how we learn to write is we write a lot, right? Part of how we come with good ideas is we have to generate ideas. And the good thing about school is we can create a space for that to happen. That means some classes will ban ChatGPT, some classes will embrace it. As I said at the beginning, entrepreneurship class, I have a different goal than I might if I was teaching, you know, how to have basic reading and writing skills. On the other hand, I think this is a general problem that we're all going to be facing, which is there is this phenomenon that, you know, once we start using AI of called falling asleep at the wheel, where we stop paying attention because the AI looks good enough, even if it's making mistakes, it looks like the material is good enough and right enough. So we're going to be very careful as teachers, but we also can't be blind to the fact that if we just assign essays, that those essays are not going to be ChatGPT written by most people. So it means taking an active decision about whether you're using this in your class or not. If you're not, how are you enforcing not using it? Because you can't just use gut feel or detector. If you are using it, how are you using it to enhance learning? So there's a lot lost and a lot gained, but it's already happening, right? So it's not like a thing we can wait on.
So how would you advise someone who's teaching English composition, or perhaps let's move it down sort of the continuum to someone who's teaching middle school English? How would you advise them about using something like ChatGPT? Because as Kathy stated, like, the process of learning how to write and generate ideas through writing is helpful for a human being's development, and you don't want to lose that.
So if you suspect that cheating is going to be a real issue, you're going to have to do a lot of the writing in class and offer critiques and other, you know, do it sort of roundtable rather than as homework assignments as they come. So a lot more in class. Well, does it? I mean, you could, you know, turn off Wi-Fi for districts that have Chromebooks, right? Do it by hand if we need to do it that way. I mean, that is one way to handle it, right? Outside of class, you might use ChatGPT to actually help increase the learning output. So rather than writing their essays outside of class, maybe they'll use prompts that'll help give them feedback from different angles. Maybe you'll ask them to rewrite their essays in 6 or 7 different styles and critique them. Maybe you'll ask them to have ChatGPT write an essay and talk about how they'd improve it. So there are ways of integrating this into the learning experience while still maintaining some of what we have, but it requires change. We can't just do things the same way.
We have people want to talk to you, Ethan. We have another caller, Gerhard, wants to talk about the future. Welcome to Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Well, I have a major question and I have a very minor comment. The minor comment is there's something called GPT-0, apparently, that can statistically help detect a lot of ChatGPT users. The major question is, given what's happened in terms of chess and Go, you know, like AlphaGo, do you see that over the next maybe 5 to 10 years, knowledge work or large chunks of knowledge work will become basically devalued, if not irrelevant, because the AI will just be better than all the rest of us, or most of the rest of us?
Interesting.
And thank you so much, Gerhard. What do you think about that?
Okay, so my first thing on ChatGPT-0, we actually now have academic papers. These don't work. The detectors don't work. Do not use them. Again, false positives against people. Like, it accuses people who...
As of now, they don't work.
They will never work.
They will never work.
Yes, we know they're not going to work.
Okay.
Right? At least as far as we can tell right now, every paper shows it's not happening. The people who actually build the models have pulled them off the market. Do not trust ChatGPT-0 or any of these other methods. We actually know that there's papers showing that these don't work, right? High mistakes. The second thing I would is on the bigger question, that is the big question, right? We already have early research that shows that in real work tasks, AI decreases the amount of time to do, you know, high-end white-collar analytical work tasks by 30 to 80% and ends up with better results. And that's programming, marketing, writing. Like, we have controlled studies that show this. What does that mean is the question we're all going to be grappling with for the years to come. Does that mean that we get to move on to do more interesting work because our boring work is outsourced to AI? Does it mean that it devalues some of these jobs that used to be very valuable? There's a whole bunch of studies now that look at where generative AI is going to have the largest impact. That means not necessarily replacing jobs, but overlapping with them. It's going to overlap most with the most creative, highly paid, highly educated jobs. And so that's something we'll have to address.
And I have to push back a little bit because ethics, you know, I taught ethics, journalism, law, and ethics, and I'm thinking about some of the unethical uses that could possibly be here. We're already seeing people talk about bias. We're always seeing people talk about misuse of intellectual property. I mean, there has to, are these going to be fixed or are we just going to mow over some of these ethical issues as this technology moves forward?
So I think those are really good questions, right? But there's bias in all sorts of levels, bias in how the models output things, right? There's subtle gender biases in how they produce content that's already been documented. There's biases in what data they're trained on. They're mostly trained on easily accessible data that is from, you know, from in English, right, from Wikipedia and other sources. There are issues, like you said, of IP. No one's asked for permission, and there's pirated copies of books in the training material. There is a lot of questions, right? So part of the question is deciding whether or not how you feel about that. How do we teach our students to be critical about AI and use AI as part of the workload here? But it's all happening very fast. I can't tell you whether it's going to stop. I don't think so. There certainly seems to be no indication that the major AI studios are going to stop, AI labs are going to stop building AI. So I'm sort of a pragmatist here, which is we have to address the negatives, and there's a lot of them, figure out what the positives are, and figure out how do we teach students in a new world that we didn't necessarily ask for, that has some upsides, but is here.
Just want to end with a quick comment. No response needed here, Ethan, but Angela emailed and said that using the prompts through ChatGPT has helped her own elementary school age child ask better questions, and that's a valuable skill to develop. So there are positives, there are negatives, and there are a lot of unknowns. This was a fascinating conversation.
Excellent, yeah.
Ethan Mollick is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School using ChatGPT quite actively in his classroom this semester and many to come. Ethan, really appreciate the time.
Thank you.
And coming up, new details about early settlers at Avery's Rest near Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. something no one expected to find. Looking forward to that discussion.
From the future to the past,
from
just
the
like
future
that.
To the past, Avi, you got it.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I am Cherry Gregg. A decade ago, archaeologists in Delaware discovered an unmarked burial site with 11 skeletons of European and African descent near Rehoboth Beach, dating back to the 17th century. The site is known as Avery's Rest, named after the early colonial era landowner John Avery.
But initially, Cherry, we didn't know a lot about who these 11 people were until now. Using DNA analysis, researchers have learned a lot about these people, the tough lives they lived trying to survive in the early colonial days. Raquel Fleskus is an anthropological geneticist who did this study and joins us now to tell us more about it. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on.
We're excited to have you. So you all have been researching the DNA from the ancestral remains found in Delaware, and there was a report that was published over the summer. What were those discoveries that were made, and why are they so significant?
Yeah, so our research that just came out a few months ago in the publication Current Biology looked at the whole genomes of these 11 ancestral individuals that were found at Avery's Rest. So when I say whole genomes, we're talking our 23 chromosomes, our sex autosomes, and we can look at these DNA data to tell us things like our ancestry or origins, where we come from, biological sex, and also biological relatedness. So with the Avery's Rest individuals, we looked for first ancestry. We found that 8 individuals were of European descent and 3 individuals were of African descent. And what's interesting is that they're separated by 15 to 20 feet apart. So we have a group of 8 in the south and a group of 3 in the north. But really interestingly, what we found is that we have biological kin structures in between each of these different burial groupings. We found a grandmother, mother, and an infant child of European descent, and a father and a son of African descent. And this is really important because it shows us and documents the visibility of biological family in early colonial settlements. A lot of times we're thinking about young male migrant labor coming to the colonial North American landscapes, and also enslaved African individuals being forcibly brought to these landscapes. So here we're actually thinking more about, well, what was life like for these individuals? What is the role of family? What is the role of women and children here at Avery's Rest?
So the fact that these groups of people were separate, but near each other in terms of where they were buried, why is that significant? What might it be telling us?
Yeah, I mean, it was really unexpected. Usually what we see is that folks of European and African descent are usually interred in completely separate burial spaces, usually following things like antebellum period down in the south of the United States. But here at Avery's Rest, they're separated only 15 to 20 feet apart. And we attribute this to being in a very frontier landscape. It's a very rural location. There are not a lot of people in this area. So what we're seeing here at Avery's Rest is more of an experience of living in these frontier locales where folks are having to work on the same plantation site in order to grow food, to survive, and also to just kind of live in these really sparsely located areas.
And so how did the ancestral remains tell you anything about how these individuals lived and how old they were, just so, and how they died? Like, what did the bones tell you about their life?
Yeah, so this work, the study of the bones, we also call this osteology, was conducted by the Smithsonian Institution. So they can look at bones to be able to tell age, so what time, what, how old they were when they passed away. We see that most people at Avery's Rest are in their mid-30s. One woman was about 50 to 60 years old, so she was really, really old, which is pretty unusual for this time period. We can also look at the bones for lived experience. So, you know, how much work are they doing in their lives? We know from Avery's Rest, the study of their bones, that they have very robust bones. They're doing a lot of heavy labor. We see when we study their vertebrae, so this is your spinal column, you get impressions in the vertebral body, and those impressions come from doing a lot of loading on top of the spine. Now, what's unique here, too, is that we see that these vertebral loadings and these robust bones are found both for the individuals of European descent and the individuals of African descent. So what this, again, is going back to is this frontier experience where everybody is having to do a lot of labor. However, what we don't know is the allocation of that labor, which was likely in law along racial and enslavement boundaries.
Right. And so this larger narrative or theme emerges of at least on some level, people living among each other, working with each other in this particular part of Delaware at this particular time. Did we have any sense that that was possible or happening before this particular site was excavated? Or is that like completely new to us?
Well, in terms of Avery's Rest, knowing that there were persons of African descent found there was completely new until the burials were fully excavated. We know from archival documents that the site was occupied by John Avery and his family, and likely some tenant farmers and indentured servants. But, you know, we know that for persons of African descent, there were supposed to be less than 500 persons there in Delaware by 1700. So it was really unexpected to find three individuals of African descent at Avery's Rest. So it adds a completely different dimension on what this frontier rural life was like in 17th century Delaware.
Yeah, I think about how technology has changed over, you know, the past years and what this DNA technology allows you to be able to do as far as like tracing these specifically folks of African descent back to where they're from. What did it tell you about where they were brought from and in, as far and tell you about the slave trade itself when it comes to Delaware?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what we would do is basically analyze the DNA of these ancestors and compare them to contemporary populations across the world. And that way we can infer origins or ancestry, right? What we found for the individuals of African descent at Avery's Rest is that they're coming from very different areas. Mm-hmm. So we have signatures for West Central Africa, as well as the Upper Gold Coast and kind of more Upper Africa. And what's interesting is that the father and the son, the child has a very different kind of profile than the father. And this suggests that that child's mother, who was not found at the site, was coming from a different area than the father is. So what this paints for us is that this is a very, very beginning of the transatlantic slave trade for the kind of eastern part of North America. We don't really have very good records about who these people were, where they were brought from. So what this shows us is that it's pretty, you know, it's pretty wide, and we really just don't have a good understanding other than, you know, they're kind of being brought from all over.
You mentioned records there, Raquel, about a minute left. I would imagine that, you know, the anthropological field, the historical field, for a long time were very much beholden to what was written down. Now you have these new tools that allow you to go beyond what was written and find and prove new things that may have been written out of history. How is your field changing as a result of this new technology?
Yeah, so I think, you know, our field is learning how to work with and work beyond these archival documents. You know, archival documents oftentimes will write the history of often white male settlers, and it's really difficult to see beyond those lines in terms of what was life like for women and children and folks of African descent. So when we use DNA technology to kind of look at these histories that are often not written about, we can learn so much more about this past that, you know, forms our roots for this, for our this area here. We see, you know, histories of relatedness. We see origins in terms of things that we didn't know before. So it's learning to work with, but also beyond, to kind of expand these narratives.
That is Raquel Fleskis, an anthropological geneticist at Dartmouth University, talking about the fascinating discoveries at Avery's Rest. Raquel, thank you so much for the time on Studio 2.
Thank you so much.
Couldn't believe all of that near Rehoboth Beach.
It's amazing what lies Delaware. Right below the surface sometimes. Yeah.
And that wraps up our show for today. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks engineered today's show. For more Studio 2, you can head on over to whyy.org/studio2 or download us wherever you get your pods. And please rate and review.
Rate and review.
From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philly, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thank you so much for joining us.